the VNA appointed me as a provenance curator in 2018 to specifically look at the Gilbert collection, which is an incredibly impressive collection of works of decorative arts, which has many objects in the collection that have an unclear provenance with respect to the Nazi period, or that have otherwise significant gaps. And my task is to investigate this collection and to find out if there are objects in it which were looted under the Nazis so that they can be restituted.
Welcome to Warfare of Art and Law, the podcast that focuses on how justice does or doesn't play out when art and law overlap. Hi everyone, it's Stephanie, and that was Dr. Jacques Schumacher, Senior Provenance Research Curator with the Victoria and Albert Museum. In the following conversation, Dr. Schumacher goes into more depth about the Gilbert Collection, the inspiration for and works included in the Concealed Histories exhibition, the process for the important work of provenance research, and the guidelines applied to restitution claims. Dr. Jacques Schumacher, welcome to Warfare of Art and Law. Thank you so very much for being on the podcast. I would like to start off with your thoughts on why you researched Nazi-looted art in the UK. How did that come about, and what's your perspective on it?
Stephanie, thank you very much for inviting me on your podcast. That's a really, really interesting question. And I think for most of their history, British museums thought that sort of Nazi-era provenance, they thought of it as a subject that would affect museums in Germany and museums in countries that were formerly occupied by the Nazis. But this idea that even a museum like the VNA, which was badly hit by German bombs during the Second World War and which had former monuments men among its curators after the war, that a museum like the VNA could unintentionally acquire objects which the Nazis had confiscated, an idea that British museums really didn't have on their radar in the post-war period. And it took decades for this to become a priority for museums.
And it's over 1,000 objects in the Gilbert collection, is that right?
Yeah, it's over 1,000 objects, and the collection is mainly known for its British and European masterpieces. It contains incredibly impressive items of gold and silver, snuff boxes, which were primarily used as intimate or diplomatic gifts, portrait miniatures, which I find absolutely fascinating. They were essentially sort of the Instagram of the day in the past, where sort of people carried small portrait miniatures of their loved ones with them. It contains micro mosaics, which are often overlooked by our visitors, because if you look at them from a distance, they look like ordinary paintings, and you really, really have to step closer to realize that they in fact consist of thousands of small individual pieces, and they are my absolute favorite in the collection. We owe this collection to Rosalind Gilbert. They were born as the children of Jewish immigrants from Eastern Europe. And Rosalind was a fashion designer. She met Arthur at, I think it's Madame Tussauds, and he joined her business. He was responsible for running the business side of their affairs. It was a hugely successful business. And then after the war, they moved to Los Angeles, where Arthur Gilbert became an incredibly successful real estate tycoon, which was sort of the requirement to be able to put together such an amazing collection. So from the 1960s onwards, Arthur and his wife, they would buy objects at auction and build this massive collection. And then the collection returned to the UK and is now on display at the V&A in dedicated galleries.
One of the points that wasn't really on the radar of collectors like the Gilberts, I think, at the time they were building this collection, was looking for gaps in provenance. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. And I think we have to remind ourselves of the reasons why someone like Arthur Gilbert collected objects. When he was interviewed about this, he said that he collected because he liked beautiful things. Right? So if he was mesmerized by the objects, that was the reason why he wanted to have them. But he was also someone who really liked history. But for him, history meant, in the first place, aristocrats and prestigious collectors. So, for example, he bought snuff boxes which had belonged to Frederick the Great of Prussia. And for him to be able to afford, but which also came with such a prestigious provenance, for him that was sort of great significance. And the dealers, of course, they knew this. And so when they offered him objects, they always said sort of, look, this was in the collection of, let's say, for example, William Randolph Hearst, this object. And from the perspective of a collector, having this information meant several things. It meant that the object came with a stamp of approval. It meant that someone else who was famous and influential had bought it in the past. So it came with this endorsement. It also could remove doubts concerning the authenticity of an object, for example, because if it was owned by a king and you know that the king commissioned certain makers to make these objects, there are no doubts about authenticity. So it adds to the prestige and value of an object. And the idea that we look at provenance and the first thing that we think about are potential problems is a relatively recent one. In fact, it's one that only really emerged towards the end of Arthur Gilbert's career as a collector. So for most of the time that he was an active collector, provenance was only seen as something that was important if it enhanced the value and prestige of an object. And the turning point really was when in the 90s, Nazi-looted art was discovered in museums in the US, and this then became an issue for the international art market. And it's something that would have shocked someone like Arthur Gilbert, because he was Jewish. Throughout his life, he had generously made contribution towards charities who commemorated the victims and so on. So he was someone who was sort of acutely aware of the horrors of the Holocaust, but he did not really have it on his radar that the fact that he bought objects without having a complete provenance meant that theoretically he could have acquired objects which had been looted by the Nazis.
And one example that jumps to mind from the Gilbert collection that I saw was the jeweled gold-mounted snuff box that had been in the Gutmann family collection. And that was one where it was decades missing. Would you talk about that piece?
Yeah, I mean, it's a very, very, it's a piece with a very, very interesting and difficult provenance. And it also illustrates how little we often know about the object. So in the case of the Gutmann snuffbox, we know that the owner of the Dresdner Bank in Germany, which was the first bank which had a presence on the high street in Germany, so a hugely influential man, incredibly wealthy, and his wealth enabled him to put together an incredibly impressive collection of works of decorative art. And it was published as part of his collection, in the collection carried their accomplishments as a collector. And then the box reappears at an auction in the 1980s in Switzerland, which is where it was acquired by an art dealer, and then subsequently was acquired by Arthur Gilbert, and it is now on display at the V&A. What this means is that the catalog of the Eugen Gutmann collection and the auction catalog in the 1980s, where this object was acquired. So the reason why this is concerning is that members of the Goodman family were persecuted by the Nazis and murdered by the Nazis, which is why it's so important to closely examine and to sort of clearly communicate as a museum what we know and what we do not know about the objects. So in the case of the Goodman box, the goal is to clarify the status of who owned the box after it was published in this catalog. Did it stay in the family? Was it sold? Who was the owner who gave it? Who owned it? Who was the consigner at the auction in the 1980s? So it's about eliminating uncertainties. And I've done a huge amount of research on this particular object, but we still don't have clarity about the status of the object. But what I can do at the BNA is that we can be sort of open about what we know about the objects, that we can focus on researching the objects and communicating these stories to our visitors.
Talking about even generally the complexity of provenance research, it's sort of a good example, would you say, of that, because the Nazi inventory doesn't even include it. And that doesn't mean that the Nazis didn't take it. It just means it could have been gone from the collection before then, or it could have just been taken as the cream of the crop by the people that were doing the inventory. Any manner of things could have happened that we just couldn't see from the records.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. So there's always, as I said, what we know for certain is that it was documented as part of the Eugen Goodman collection. And we know that it reappeared or resurfaced at an auction in the 1980s. And we know that Friedrich Goodman was persecuted and murdered by the Nazis, and that in the 1940s, his art collection was taken to Munich, and that there was an inventory of the objects which were taken. And we know that the box, which is now on display at the V&A, wasn't on this inventory. And there are sort of different ways of thinking about this, right? Sort of one theory would, for example, be that the object left the collection after Eugen Goodman's death, right? That it sort of continued to circulate on the art market. Another option would be that Friedrich Goodman sold the gold box before the Nazis invaded the Netherlands, where he lived. So there, because we don't have documents that provide clarity about this, this is sort of a particularly difficult and interesting case to talk about. We have other cases in the collection where there were massive red flags, and I was almost absolutely certain that the object in question, right? So in fact, the first object that I looked at was an object from a Jewish collection, which was confiscated by the Nazis in 1938. And it was really unclear when I started my research what happened to these objects. And some of these objects went on about this. So it's a collection that belonged to Maximilian von Goldschmidt-Rothschild, who was a banker in Frankfurt am Main. He married into the Rothschild dynasty, a family which, of course, sort of occupied sort of a very important spot sort of in this sort of Nazi imagination of a Jewish world conspiracy. The fact that he was a wealthy collector was widely known. And in 1938, the Nazi mayor of Frankfurt exploited the anti-Semitic violence to force Maximilian von Goldschmidt-Rothschild to sell his art collection to the museums of the city of Frankfurt. And the museums, they sent their curators to Maximilian von Goldschmidt-Rothschild's mansion, where they carefully cataloged the collection. And then they turned his mansion into an outpost of the Museum of Applied Art in Frankfurt. Maximilian died in 1940, all of his members of staff were Jewish, and they were all deported and murdered. And a lot of these objects then, or some of these objects then, disappeared from the collections of the Museum of Applied Art. And we don't really know what happened there. It's possible that they were destroyed during bombing, or maybe a curator sort of took them, or maybe someone else stole them. So I only got clarity about this when I went to Frankfurt and I looked at the restitution records, and I in fact found a receipt which demonstrated that this particular gold box had been restituted to the family after the war. And so this is sort of one example where when I began my research, I was very, very concerned about the provenance. But maybe I should also explain that the decision about what should happen to a piece is not a decision that the museum has to make, which gives me great freedom. So in my role, I can focus entirely on researching the provenance and sharing with the public what I know about the objects and where our gaps are. And in the UK, the decision about the future of an object is made by a panel of experts. These are historians, lawyers, members of the art trade, and so on, who have no interest in preserving the collections of the V&A. Right? So they are not biased in any way. And in a case where members of a family who was persecuted by the Nazis feel, if they feel that there's sufficiently strong evidence to support their claim, this claim is then reviewed by these experts, who will then issue a recommendation which museums are then expected to follow. And we had one example in the 1980s. The V&A acquired a piece from a British collector who lived in Rome, who had bought it from a Russian dealer in Paris without information about the provenance, right? So it wasn't seen as important. And it was then discovered in 2010, I think, that the piece had belonged to a Jewish collector whose collection was forcibly sold at auction. And so a claim was made. The V&A looked at the evidence and supported the claim, because the evidence was completely straightforward, because there was clear evidence, clear documents, which left no doubt that the object had belonged to this collector, and that the collection was forcibly sold was also clear. But I think one of the most interesting insights into provenance research, and something that I didn't sort of properly realize before I started, is that even with a lot of research, it is often impossible to get absolute clarity, which is why personally I'm quite glad that difficult decisions about sort of what the consequences are of this research, that this that have to be made by me or the museum.
The collector you were talking about in those pieces, those were the Meissen statuettes?
Yeah, so the objects which were restituted were Meissen pieces, which were acquired by the V&A in the 1980s, so they have nothing to do with the Gilbert collection. I just mentioned them because it's the so far the only restitution V&A, which in itself is incredibly interesting, because in the 90s, when Nazi looting became or was placed on the agenda of British museums, the general expectation was that there would be thousands of restitution cases, which only seems logical. If you look at the collections of the V&A, for example, the V&A acquired hundreds of thousands of objects from 1933 onwards without asking in-depth questions about their provenance. So like a collector like Arthur Gilbert, curators at the V&A, they acquired an object because they thought it was sort of an interesting example of design which they wanted to put on display at their museum. And they had to convince the director that the piece was worthy of being included in the museum's collection. And one way to do this was to emphasize that it had belonged to a famous collector before, an aristocrat. But the goal was never to to reconstruct a complete unbroken chain of provenance. It was simply not necessary at the time. And what I think is incredibly interesting is that this did not change in the 1940s when former monuments men joined the museum, who knew fully well that not all the objects which were looted by the Nazis were recovered and restituted. But these acquisition protocols, which had been in place since the 1850s, they remained essentially unchanged until 1998.
And even the deaccession laws that would control what the museums like V&A do with their collection, that is was only recently dealt with in 2009 with the Holocaust Act. How has that impacted what you do with pieces or the recommendations that are made?
Yeah, I mean that's something that it's an absolutely astonishing story. And to understand it, I think I need to provide a bit of background information. So for most of its history, the V&A was part of the government, and it was the government's decision what should happen with certain pieces in the collection. So if the government decided that a piece should be given to someone else, then this was possible without major problems. In the 1980s, the management of the museum was transferred to a board of trustees, and the government didn't trust these trustees enough to preserve the collection, which is why they passed a law which said that the trustees should preserve the collection and that they can only remove objects from the collection if the object is a duplicate, if it is damaged beyond repair, if they want to give it to a different museum in the UK, and if it's unsuitable for the collection, which means that no visitor, researcher, student is interested in the object. So that's completely useless for at the museum. And you can see where I'm getting at. So none of this applies to objects which are the subject of restitution claims. And so when in the 1990s, British Nazi looted art was a problem for them, even when specific pieces were found, where there was no doubt that that they were looted by the Nazis, the museum was not able to restitute these pieces, which was, of course, an incredibly embarrassing situation for the museums. So they campaigned to have different laws. So for the V&A is the National Heritage Act. And it took until 2009 that this law was passed. And it was extended indefinitely in 2019, which means that Nazi era be an issue for museums, because they will always be able to restitute pieces. So that means if they want to acquire an object now, they need to look closely at the provenance to ensure that they don't acquire a problematic piece. And your question was about the significance of this law, which pushed the door wide open for restitution. And I think so. At the time, I think when the law was passed, the culture secretary said that this law removed an anomaly that many people were surprised existed in the first place. I think it's a brilliant law, because it provides a clear framework, clear procedure for restitution cases. So how it works in practice is that if a piece is discovered in the collections of a national museum like the V&A, a claim can be made to the spoliation advisory panel of experts who are independent and who will review the evidence And if they recommend the restitution of a piece, and if the Secretary for Culture agrees with them, then the object can be restituted by the museum, and all these decisions are published on of the UK Spoliation Advisory Panel. Incredibly thorough and detailed report. One of the best resources for researchers who are interested in how museums in Britain have dealt with Nazi-era restitution issues.
For the items in the Gilbert collection that have raised red flags, you've started the process of going through the over 1,000 objects, and where do you stand with your research? And then do you make recommendations to the panel to look at certain objects?
So when I started at the museum, my colleague Alice Minter, who's the curator for the Gilbert, she worked at Sotheby's before, so brilliant art historian. We looked at all the objects in the collection, and we identified 80 objects which either had significant gaps in their provenance or which had certain red flags. So, for example, you mentioned the box from the Eugen Goodman collection, a Jewish collector who lived in Germany, for example, and then there's a significant gap between for the time period between the publication of his collection and the auction in 1980. So these were objects which we looked at, or for example, auction houses, certain auction houses in Germany where we know that the Jewish property was sold during the 1930s and 1940s. In general, so the names of German and Jewish collectors. And I'm still in the process of researching the objects on this list. The problem for museums is that it's incredibly difficult to get clarity about the objects. So there are basically two different ways of researching this. Let's assume you are a member of a family. You know that members of your family were persecuted by the Nazis. The challenge for you is to find the objects. Right? So you will probably have an inventory of what the member of your family owned. And now the challenge is to find the object. It might be in a private collection, it might resurface at an auction at any minute, or it could be in a collection of a museum. But if you are a museum and you have thousands of objects or hundreds of thousands of objects, much about their provenance, it's quite difficult to find out if this object belonged to a Jewish family, for example, who were persecuted under the Nazis, because there's no definitive list of objects which were looted under the Nazis as good as the information that's in them. So it requires sort of somebody that somebody makes an active effort and submits information about objects. But because there are so many objects which don't have provenance information, and in most cases the reason why they don't have provenance information is completely innocent, right? Because as I said, so provenance information was not important to dealers or collectors in the 1960s. And there are legitimate reasons for not wanting to see your name in the provenance of an object that you decided to sell. Right? So you could have an aristocrat who is slightly embarrassed that he needs to sell something that his family has owned for centuries, potentially. Or you have sellers who have security because they have valuable objects in their home, or that they just made a lot of money at an auction. So there are a lot of concerns. And in many cases, after months of research and trips to archives and libraries, you then find out that the provenance of the piece is completely innocent. So there's a lot of, it's incredibly time consuming, this research. And so we have in the Concealed Histories display, which I curated with Alice Minter, we put on display 8 objects which have a connection to the Nazi past that we were previously unaware of. And this was quite a significant step for British Museum, because when British museums in the 1990s started to investigate Nazi-era provenance issues, they did a lot of research, but this was something that was perceived as a legal issue that sort of fell outside the normal realm of responsibility of a museum, which museums are, of course, normally incredibly good at talking about the objects on display and sort of explaining their thinking about them and so on. But in the case of objects that could potentially be the subject of restitution claims, this traditionally hasn't been the case in Germany. So it was a major step that a museum in the UK finally put together a special display and said, look, these are objects which have a provenance that we never talked about before, that normally doesn't get talked about in British museums. And there are two categories of objects. They are objects which belong to Jewish collectors. They were persecuted. The objects were taken by the Nazis, and then they were restituted. And we want to give visitors an opportunity to learn about the experiences and the suffering of these people. Whereas if you just look at it from a legal perspective, if you would just say, okay, fine, a piece was looted, it was restituted, there's no restitution issue, let's not talk about it. But I still think that it's an incredibly important opportunity for visitors to learn about this dark history. And then there are pieces like the object from the like the snuffbox from the Eugen Goodman collection, where we have red flags and we talk about these red flags to our visitors. And one of the reasons for putting these objects is on display, because I think it's very, very important to that museum goers realize how difficult provenance research can be, and that even a lot of research sometimes does not produce the clear answers that you want. And another reason, of course, is that somebody might come to the museum and say, I know something about this object. And I received many, many emails from visitors who asked me questions and who shared historical documents with me. So this was, I think, a really, really productive idea for all these reasons that I just outlined.
Have there been any claims by heirs or requests by alleged heirs who potentially would like the object from their family and they've seen it in the Gilbert collection?
No, and that's something that I think is very, very interesting. There haven't been any claims, and I think for objects that are on display at the V&A, it would be incredibly. These objects are very easy to be discovered. The V&A is a major museum. The collections are available online, and if you think at objects that are in smaller regional museums, which don't have the money to spend millions, look at the objects. And in fact, the reason why the Meissen piece was discovered, which I mentioned earlier, which was then restituted in 2012, was that the V&A published the entirety of its collections online in 2009 and sort of removed this problem for researchers and families who in the 1990s, it would have been incredibly difficult to find out what is in where the objects are and what is in the V&A's collections. You would have to go to the museum, look at index cards, acquisition records, and now you can just go on a website. No, we have not received any claims, but this might change at this stage. It doesn't seem to be a publicized exhibition, and countless articles of the art newspaper, for example, published photos of the objects and the known provenance and the attention that was brought to these objects. No, there have not been any claim this play has done for the provenance and restitution debate in the UK was quite significant, because it has demonstrated that there is an enormous interest among visitors in these stories, which fall outside for art and design. It's something that you would probably suspect to find in a history museum, right? But it's a very unusual. And I have been in communication with colleagues at other museums who are now also thinking about putting on similar displays. And we had a lot of interest from schools and students who are now interested in writing and researching objects, who have taken objects and investigated them in quite a lot of detail and written about sort of the restitution debate in the UK.
I was curious how the idea for the exhibit came about. I'd seen where, I believe in mid-2019, there was the Magdala 1868 exhibit that was about cultural objects from Ethiopia. And so I thought, well, maybe that kind of opened a door for the idea of doing that with Nazi looted art, but maybe there was no connection at all. I was curious.
No, there's absolutely a connection. In fact, when the Magdala A I interviewed for the job as a provenance curator. So I walked past this display and I thought, this is absolutely fantastic to see that this museum, which has many other problematic objects in its collections, is putting on a display in collaboration with the Ethiopian embassy, which talks openly about how these are putting this on to platform what was an incredibly live debate at the time. So you'll probably you'll all remember that Macron gave a speech in 2017, and then he commissioned this report, and there were all these newspapers showing sign that that the V&A was incredibly serious about provenance research. Because when I talked to colleagues at other museums in Germany, for example, how it works there is that provenance researchers often join a museum, and then their task is just to check the status of the collection, just to make sure that there isn't a problematic object there. And this is where it ends in most cases. So they spend 1 or 2 years researching the collections. They learn all these stories about collectors. They learn about objects which are problematic, but also about objects which are unproblematic from a legal perspective. And the museum research. And I thought that, I thought that was absolutely fantastic when I interviewed for my job. And I also, it was the, I presented my research at a meeting, and then our director, Tristram Hunt, who joined the museum in 2017, he suggested a provenance display. And then Alice Minter and I started to work on it. And we thought that it would be a small display, and nobody really knew how it would be received in the UK. But what was very reassuring is that a colleague at the Nelson Atkins, Mackenzie Mellon, had put on a display called Discriminating Thieves, which was a huge inspiration for us. So we, in a way, our display followed the footsteps of the Magdala display, which was curated by my colleague Alex Jones, who then left the museum and is now writing a PhD about the topic, and the display at the Nelson Atkins museum, which made it clear that this is a topic which which can generate a lot of interest among visitors at an art museum outside of Germany or outside a country which was formerly occupied by the Nazis, where this connection is not as direct as before.
Have you done any work in the cultural heritage area outside of the Nazi looted art?
Yeah, I think what I think is very, very interesting is that that the research into Nazi looted art often takes place in isolation from other, that is sort of that is detached from other restitution debates. Perfectly understandable reasons for it, because it requires a specific skill set. You need to be able to be German and so on, and you need to be familiar with the history of Nazi persecution. But it's an area where a lot of progress has been made. And I think it's quite interesting that there that we don't look at it more to learn lessons about how we could approach other restitution cases as well. And obviously, I'm conscious of the fact that there are significant differences between all of these areas, but I still think that it's valuable to look at them and to see what lessons can be learned. In the 1990s, there was this concern that that by comparing different restitution cases, for example, if you compare Nazi persecution to colonial atrocities, for example, that this would mean to downplay one of them. And I don't think that this is a valid argument, especially not at a museum. Curators know better than anyone else that if you compare two things, that doesn't mean that they are the same. You compare them to get clarity about the differences, important lessons. So I also contribute to the V&A's other restitution and provenance efforts. And you've mentioned the Ethiopian treasures, which were part of the Magdala 1868 campaign. And so there was this amazing display, and the V&A is currently in negotiations with the Ethiopian embassy to ensure that these really, really important cultural artifacts can also be seen in Ethiopia.
That is still hampered by the deaccession laws. Unlike the Holocaust Act of 2009, there's nothing that speaks directly to cultural objects like the Ethiopian cultural heritage. Is that the case?
That's absolutely correct. So the Heritage Act says you can't deaccession, which is the museum term for removing an object from the collection to give it to someone else. You can't do this. So I mentioned the different criteria earlier, but if the object is a duplicate, damaged beyond repair, unsuitable for retention, or if you want to give it to someone else. So none of these restrictions, none of these exceptions apply to objects that were looted by British troops during the colonial period, which means that the only way in which a museum can address a restitution claim for such objects is to offer to place these items on loan to a different museum or institution. And the reason why this proves difficult is that the criticism is that somebody who had something stolen from them should not have to borrow it back. So that's the criticism of this position. At the V&A, the idea to use long-term loans to address restitution claims was really emerged in 1999, when it was discovered that the V&A had bought in the 1950s a silver item, not knowing that it had been stolen during a church festival in Spain in the 1890s. So no military looting in ordinary art theft in the 1890s in Spain during a church festival. And the V&A was approached by by Spain through the British embassy in Madrid. And because the object was part of the V&A's collection and therefore the Heritage Act applied to it, the only way to return it was to place it on long-term loan to Spain. And this happened in 2005, and the loan has been periodically renewed ever since the object left the museum. So if the goal is to ensure that the objects can not only be seen in South Kensington, but that they can be also put on display in the countries of origin, then a long-term loan is a very pragmatic proposal, which comes very natural to museum curators who handle loans all the time. So a curator might process loans every single day. And curators also know that many of the objects which are on display at the V&A, for example, are in fact there on loan, on long-term loans. So for example, the Gilbert collection is on long-term loan to the V&A for over 100 years. But most people wouldn't realize this because they think because an object is part of a permanent display case at the V&A, it automatically means that it is owned by the museum. And for museum curators, because they process loans all the time, and so for them it's nothing unusual. But if somebody who's not familiar with this museum world, if they hear that the response is that a country should borrow an object, I can completely understand why such an offer attracts some criticism. But I think from a purely pragmatic perspective, it is the right thing to do. And laws can always change, but I don't think that we should wait for the law to be changed before objects are returned to their countries of origin. I mean, we talked about this earlier, that it took more than 10 years for the Holocaust Act to be passed.
And you are on, I believe, the Arts Council's Restitution Working Group for Colonial Era Artifacts. Is that right?
Yeah, that's correct. So in 2019, museum associations in various European countries issued guidelines and recommendations on how museums should approach should deal with restitution claims pertaining to items in their collections that were looted by European troops, for example, or that were collected by scientific explorers. And the last time that such guidance was issued was in the UK, was in the late 90s or in the year 2000. So it was felt that an updated guidance was needed that reflects the progress that has been made over the course of the past 20 years. And this is something that's currently in development, and I very much hope that it will become available soon.
And I had recently heard, just as an aside to the long-term loan topic we were just discussing, I'd recently heard about some museums that did not have a policy for virtual loans. And I wondered if you were aware of the V&A being approached for a virtual loan to a virtual museum, or if that was something that had been discussed by anyone in your sector.
That's a really, really interesting. Can you tell me more about the idea of a virtual museum?
Yeah, there's a virtual museum. They have masterpieces that are on virtual loan from major museums, as well as lesser known artists. And sometimes they would ask a museum if they could have a virtual loan of a piece, and the museum would say, no, we don't have a policy on that. So no. And so I wondered, because we are in very much the virtual museum era, if there ever was one. So
virtual reality experience with VR goggles, or is this a website?
It's a website. So you 24 hours a day, you can go in, and it's free to anyone. And I'll send you the link for where I heard about it. Yeah.
That would be great. I mean, there has been a lot of talk about sort of, it's sometimes referred to as digital restitution, where the idea is to make knowledge sort of widely accessible. But I don't think that scanning objects or reproductions or high resolution scans of certain objects fundamentally address what restitution claims are really about. They are, at first glance, it seems straightforward. A restitution claim is about an object and legal questions of ownership, right? But in fact, they are about complex debates about the past, our changing attitudes, the specific needs of communities who were systematically deprived of their cultural heritage in the past. And I think that providing, for example, virtual copies of certain objects can be an important first step, if this means that they become, if they can be studied, for example, by researchers in the countries of origin. But it doesn't address the fundamental problem. And as far as I know, that this is like the idea or like the notion of a long-term loan, and also can attract a lot of criticism, because some might perceive it as a museum trying to sidestep the issues that are at stake. But I think it's a great idea, and I will definitely take a look at it.
Do you have any current book projects that you are working on?
I'm working on a provenance research handbook for curators and researchers who are interested in this topic in English-speaking countries, because there's a lot of interest from students and colleagues, and their motivation there's a wide range of different motivations. Some of them want to research specific families and trace their collections. Others want to look at how museums dealt with provenance and restitution issues. And others have real practical concerns. They want to buy an object, for example, and they are uncertain about the provenance, and they want to know what steps they can of the relevant piece. And in 2000, the last English handbook or guide on provenance research was published, which was put together after the Washington Conference, where museums in the UK and in the US started to systematically confront this issue, and they went through their collections. And it's a brilliant book, but obviously a lot has happened since then, and especially in the realm of digital resources, databases, but also historical documents that became available online. So I thought that would be a good time to address this interest and this need for an updated handbook for an English-speaking audience. So I hope that the book will be published next year. The research has been quite difficult because of COVID. It's difficult to go to archives, difficult to go to libraries. But I'm optimistic that the current lockdown was our last lockdown, and that I'll be able to finish it over the summer.
Well, I, for one, want that book. So I'm excited when it comes out.
Right.
Would you say that the research, and perhaps what you just said answers the question, but the idea of nothing replacing being in person to search archives yourself, as opposed to being able to do work online, to me, that would also largely depend on which institutions have put their records online. And so is that really the crux of it? The more the institutions start to put themselves into that online space, the easier it will be to do it virtually?
I mean, there has been a lot of progress. In 1998, at the Washington Conference, there was this idea that by now there would be a mega website, is what they called it, which would provide everything we know about art collectors who were persecuted by the Nazis, and everything would, and a list of all the objects in museum collections and digitized records of all the German post-war restitution records and the records of Nazi authorities, and that it would then become incredibly easy to cross-reference and to identify pieces. And a lot of progress has been made. There are incredible databases. Fold 3 has important records from the US about the Allied post-war restitution effort and certain German documents that were confiscated. There are databases, and a lot of important documents on the topic are available online, but a lot of them aren't, and there is no replacement for archival research, because relying on digital resources only can also give you a false sense of security. I mentioned the databases of looted art, which contain tens of thousands of entries. But of course, that's not the complete picture. And if you want to research the history of a specific family, then you have to write to archives to get clarity about what happened to them. So there's no replacement at this stage for archival research, and I don't think that it will be replaced in the foreseeable future, for the simple reason that there are sometimes data protection and privacy laws which stand in the way of digital resources. But of course, the archival records are also incomplete. Archives were destroyed, stolen, or documents were never even added to an archive, and they are in private collections. And I think the more research you do, the more often do you encounter cases where you spend a lot of time, energy, and money on copies and scans and so on, without getting the clarity, without solving the case. But then in other cases you do. But I also think that for a museum it's important to show that there is an effort to research these pieces, that we're not just sitting around waiting for claims to come in, and that we're not just purely reactive, but that we actively look at our own collections and then research the history of the pieces.
And for the research that you are doing, you mentioned the co-curator, I believe, that you have with the Gilbert Collection. Is there also a team of researchers that are with you doing the research of the Gilbert Collection still, or how does that work?
So the Gilbert Collection is a small team. It's a curator and an assistant curator, and we work really, really well together. And when I look at other provenance issues at the museum, I work with the responsible curators, who are incredibly knowledgeable about the objects, and then I try to find out more about who owned these objects in the past. But and sometimes ask, is there a provenance research department at the V&A? And that's the curator at the museum. And I don't have a team of researchers. I still have to go to the archives and libraries and do all the work.
You are in addition to the Gilbert Collection, then you pretty much would move throughout the entire V&A's collection, doing work as needed for certain objects. How does that arrive?
It's mostly in connection with new acquisitions. or incoming loans where the museum would like to have clarity about the status of an object. It's sometimes in response to inquiries. If somebody has particular questions or concerns about an object, and it also has to do with ongoing displays where curators would like to add would like to include provenance information, and then we work on these objects together.
What's the criteria that would be used by V&A now for an acquisition or a loan of an object? If there is a gap in the title, do they sometimes go forward with it depending on your research, or does that absolutely stop the acquisition or loan?
It depends on... So it's very, very difficult to give... an answer that applies to all possible scenarios. Generally, we check every single object that comes to the museum with respect to the provenance during the Nazi period. If it's an archaeological object, for example, we would pay particularly close attention to the year 1970 when the UNESCO Convention was passed. In contrast to what was the norm in the past, the museum would now always ask questions about the provenance. So you would ask the donor or the dealer to provide as much provenance information as they possibly can. If we are talking about an object which was created in the, let's say, 1920s and what was in Europe, then we would of course look particularly closely at the provenance during the Nazi period, which would then involve checks in the relevant databases, primarily the German Lost Art database. And if there are any concerns about the ownership, we would check, for example, the Interpol database of stolen works of art, which contains, I think it's 60,000 entries of confirmed stolen objects. So this information is provided by the police, by the member states of Interpol. And if there are any concerns about the provenance of an object, then the V&A would not acquire it or accept it as a loan.
Backing up to get a bigger perspective on you, what drew you into provenance research to begin with?
So I studied history, and I became very, very interested in the history of Nazi Germany, and I did my PhD looking at German and Allied war crimes. And after I completed my PhD, I joined the Commission for Looted Art in Europe as a researcher. The Commission for Looted Art in Europe is an incredibly important organization based in London that recovers cultural property lost during the Nazi period, and they do absolutely brilliant work, and that's how I became interested in provenance research, because this was an area where I could apply the skills that I had learned during my years as a student and during my PhD studies. Because in the beginning, I was a bit concerned because I thought that to be a good provenance historian, and I did not train as an art historian. But provenance research is not, in a way, the object almost doesn't matter. It's about tracing the path taken by these objects and finding these traces in archives. And if you research Nazi era provenance, if you return to the to the snuffbox from the Goodman collection, you would go to libraries and look at published collections. You would also spend a lot of time in German and Dutch archives, going through records, hoping that they will provide clarity about the status of the object. So you would, for example, look at the post-war restitution records. So I remember that I, in 2018 or 2019, I traveled to Berlin to look at the restitution records. And it has very little to do with sort of the glamorous art world. And it's mostly archival research.
Well, thank you so much, Jacques, for your expertise and sharing your insight about this. It's very much appreciated.
You're very welcome. And I should say I'm often approached by students and others who are interested in researching how a museum like the B&A deals with these issues or who are interested in specific cases. And I just wanted to say that if one of your listeners is interested in researching these topics at the B&A, if they're interested in the topic of Nazi looting or colonial era imperial looting, then I'm definitely that I would be delighted to help them, and I'm sure that we can maybe put my email address in the description. So if anyone is interested, I would be very happy to help. And the reason why I say this is that I often speak to students who have the wrong idea that it would be difficult about giving access to researchers, so they don't even try to contact them because they think automatically that their request will be left unanswered. And I've heard this so many times that I think it's really important to point out that this is not the case.
Dr. Schumacher's email will be included in the show notes, as well as a link to the Concealed Histories exhibition to learn more. If you enjoyed this podcast, it would be much appreciated if you could leave a rating or review. You can also email your comments to Stephanie@warfareofartandlaw.com. Until next time, this is Stephanie Draughty bringing you Warfare of Art and Law. Thank you so much for listening. And remember, injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. What are your plans for the second Saturday of this month? Perhaps consider joining in for a discussion about art, culture, and social issues. Hi everyone, it's Stephanie, and every second Saturday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time, I host the Second Saturday Art and Justice Gathering, an online call that explores a range of topics, from artists who might inspire to legal decisions that might infuriate, all with the aim of sparking dialogue about social justice and promoting creative thinking. If interested, please email me at Stephanie@warfareofartandlaw.com.